This is going to be a talk, actually not entirely on the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gata, but mostly on it. And what the talk will consist of is, well, first of all, just a little bit about the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras in general. So that'll be a kind of recap, a kind of catching up with where we got to last week, if you were here last week, and a brief summary of last week, if you weren't here last week. And then I'm going to talk about the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gata and how it's typical of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And then, finally, I'm going to tell you, or to talk about, to discuss a bit, what the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gata tells us about how to approach the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Okay? So, that'll be the three bits of the talk. And, you can just keep this by you. I'm going to be unconventional and not start at the beginning. But when I want you to have a look at it, I'll tell you. Okay, so first of all, a bit about Perfection of Wisdom literature generally. Because last week we had the Heart Sutra. Today we've got the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gata. And actually, that's all you're going to get on the Perfection of Wisdom. So better listen to what's said today, because if you don't catch it now, then you'll miss it completely. So, I'm going to tell you just a little bit about the history to begin with, because it's quite an interesting history. People think that the Perfection of Wisdom is a kind of advanced teaching, but actually it's thought by scholars now that it really originated at about the time of the Buddha, certainly very soon after the Buddha, if not in the time of the Buddha. And it was passed down orally, just like the stories of the Pali Canon that we heard about earlier in the series. And actually, the very earliest texts from the Perfection of Wisdom, and the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gata is probably the earliest, were written down at about the same time as the Pali Canon. So they were being written down 100 BC, perhaps a little bit earlier than that. And the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gata and the extracts that you've got were being written down for the first time at around that time. There are actually 35 sutras that make up this literature that we call the Perfection of Wisdom literature. And they've got a lot of similarities. And in fact, when we get into the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gata, you'll see how similar it is to the Heart Sutra. And actually, if you know the Heart Sutra and you know a bit about this one, then you've got a good general feel for what the Perfection of Wisdom literature is about. Not that you know it all, but that you've got a bit of a feel for it. And I wanted to say a little bit about something Sangharachitta says about the kind of phases of the Perfection of Wisdom literature. I wouldn't generally go into this sort of thing, but it's quite interesting what he says. He says the earliest two, which is this one, the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gata, and another one called the Sahasrika Pranya Paramita, or the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines. Those are the earliest two. They were written down very early. And he said, what happened next, over the next few hundred years, is that the Perfection of Wisdom literature was kind of expanded and elaborated and built upon and developed. And that's when you get the Perfection of Wisdom in 10,000 lines, and the Perfection of Wisdom in 18,000 lines, and the Perfection of Wisdom in 25,000 lines, and then the Perfection of Wisdom in 100,000 lines. So it kind of gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then, over the next few hundred years, it starts to get shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. So you get the Heart Sutra, which we looked at last week. You get the Diamond Sutra. And then you get shorter and shorter versions until you get the Dharanis, or the mantras, that we sang last week. Remember last week we had, I think, three different mantras, including the Gate Gate one that you're probably quite familiar with. And they in themselves are Perfection of Wisdom teachings. You know, so one of those mantras, one of those Dharanis, it's kind of another word for a mantra, is meant to kind of sum up, is meant to encapsulate the Perfection of Wisdom. And then, Shantavanchari said this last week, and then you get the Perfection of Wisdom in one word, and then you get the Perfection of Wisdom in one letter. So in Sanskrit, if you put R at the front of a word, it makes it negative. And one of the things you'll have noticed about the Heart Sutra, and you'll notice it about this sutra, and you'll notice it about the other Perfection of Wisdom sutras, is there's a lot of knots in them. Okay? So if you're summing up the Perfection of Wisdom in one letter, it's the letter that means not. Okay. And there's a kind of final phase when nothing at all is written down about the Perfection of Wisdom. But in the tantric phase, you get perfect wisdom not described in words, but symbolized in the goddess Pranyaparamita, the goddess that Kuladitya ran a workshop on at the weekend. Okay, so actually in a week, you've done the short Perfection of Wisdom in the Heart Sutra. Some of you have done the Pranyaparamita workshop, and so you've learned about the symbolism of the Perfection of Wisdom. And now you're going to get the very earliest, the pith teaching on the Perfection of Wisdom. So, I suppose, in a way, the crucial question is, what is the Perfection of Wisdom? What's the purpose of it? And the purpose of it, really, is about analysing the nature of reality. That's what the Perfection of Wisdom literature is all about. It's about telling you about the nature of reality. And, since enlightenment is about realising how things really are, that's pretty important, isn't it? It's what we're all aiming at. It's the source of all happiness. It's the goal of the spiritual life. So, in a way, anything that's going to point you in the direction of realising the nature of reality, realising how things really are, is really important. And that's what the Perfection of Wisdom is trying to do. It's written by enlightened beings to help us move in the direction of enlightenment and to give us a taste of reality. Okay, so now to go to the Ratnaguna Samshayagata. And, where should we start? The perfection of the Ratnaguna Samshayagata is very, very similar in most of its contents to the other Perfection of Wisdom sutras. And the second of the two verses that you've got in front of you, so the ones that are headed the basic teachings, brackets, initial verses, these are really, really typical Perfection of Wisdom writings. And in a way, they kind of sum up what not only the Ratnaguna Samshayagata is about, but what a lot of the Perfection of Wisdom literature is about. So I'm just going to read it slowly. So this will give you a chance. You can either follow the words if that helps, or you can close your eyes and listen. I'm just going to read these first two verses, and then I'm going to say a bit about them. So the basic teachings. No wisdom can we get hold of. No highest perfection. No bodhisattva. No thought of enlightenment either. When told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the well-gone's wisdom. In form, feeling, will, perception and awareness, nowhere in them they find a place to rest on. Without a home they wander. Dharmas never hold them, nor do they grasp at them. The jina's bodhi they are bound to gain. Okay. So, it probably hasn't got any of us there. Hands up if you've become enlightened just by listening to that. Hey, well done. but it is pointing at enlightenment. And it sounds, last week Shantavajri said, how do you react to the Heart Sutra? How does it sound to you? And some people said, it sounds like nonsense. And some people said, it sounds too difficult, or it sounds academic, or sounds this, sounds that. And actually, all of those things are true. It does sound incredibly learned, except that it doesn't seem to make sense because it's full of anomalies and contradictions. It sounds a bit academic, a bit intellectual, and yet it doesn't stack up. And one of the baffling things about it is that, this, like most Perfection of Wisdom literature, is full of negatives. It's full of negatives. No wisdom can we get hold of. No highest perfection. No bodhisattva. No thought of enlightenment, as translated here, but no bodhicitta either. And this isn't contrariness. It's not trying to baffle us with double and triple negatives. It's really pointing to a very profound truth, this use, this constant use of negatives. And the profound truth is that no concept can express reality. No concept can sum up things as they really are. Not even beautiful and profound concepts like wisdom and highest perfection and bodhisattva and bodhicitta. I mean, they're wonderful concepts, but they don't sum up reality, because reality isn't conceptual. It's something else. So the perfection of wisdom is about the nature of reality, but the nature of reality is not conceptual. And until we go beyond concepts, we're just not going to get it. But until we do go beyond concepts and get it, we've got to struggle with concepts, because that's all we've got. And it's to be hoped, we're told, that the concepts that we've got in the Ratnaguna Samchayagata and the other Perfection of Wisdom Sutras are concepts that will help us to move towards enlightenment, that will point us in the right direction. In a way, what we're doing here, or what the people who wrote these sutras are doing, is using words to go beyond words, using concepts to go beyond concepts, using them as a kind of launching pad, as a kind of springboard, as a kind of diving board, as a kind of launching off point. And in the fourth line of the verse, the first of those verses that I just read, a bodhisattva courses in the well-gone's wisdom. The well-gone's wisdom. The well-gone is the Buddha. And well-gone is a term that's used for the Buddha in the Perfection of Wisdom literature, because going beyond is a fundamental concept in the Perfection of Wisdom. Gone beyond means gone beyond concepts, gone beyond word, gone beyond rational thought. So the bodhisattva courses in the well-gone's wisdom. The bodhisattva courses in the wisdom of the Buddha that is beyond concepts, that's beyond words. And that's pointed at by the Pranya Paramita mantra that we chanted last week. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhi swaha. If translated, means gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond. And then swaha means something like yes, or hooray, or something like that. But it's all about going beyond. It's pointing you to beyond, going beyond concepts. So the Perfection of Wisdom is about the wisdom that's beyond words and concepts. And really, it's intended to be dropped into reflection and meditation, which is why I think the shorter of the Perfection of Wisdom sutras are really, in a way, the most useful, because you can learn them by heart. The Heart Sutra is fantastic, because once you've learnt the Heart Sutra by heart, you have got, just ready to call up at any time, the whole of the Perfection of Wisdom literature. You've got something that you can call up and just reflect on. You've got something that's going to point you at any moment that you want to in the direction of enlightenment. And if you recall it at a time when you've been meditating and your mind's feeling fairly flexible, and just take a couple of verses, just take a line even, and just reflect upon it, it's going to help to move you in the right direction. And that's what they're intended for, these Perfection of Wisdom sutras. There's a lovely myth about the Perfection of Wisdom that points to their profundity. The story goes that when the very longest Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the Perfection of Wisdom in 100,000 lines, was preached by the Buddha, it was so profound and so difficult that no one at the time of the Buddha could understand it. And so it was entrusted to the Nagas. Now, some of you will have come across nagas, but some of you won't. Nagas are kind of sea serpents. They're like mermaids and mermen, and they live in the depths of the ocean. And it was there, this perfection of wisdom in 100,000 lines. It was there with the nagas for over 500 years, until eventually there was someone in the world of human beings who had the capacity to understand it and to teach it to others. And so the story goes that 500 years after the time of the Buddha, a Mahayana sage called Nagarjuna came along and was presented with the texts by a Naga princess. So this Naga princess comes up from the depths and hands over the perfection of wisdom in 100,000 lines to Nagarjuna, in a scene that was acted out by Vajratara a couple of years ago. How many people remember Vajratara with a serpent coming out of the back of her vest and a towel wrapped around her head because she'd been to the bottom of the ocean? Okay, some people do. A famous moment in the history of the Sheffield Buddhist Centre. So in the science of symbols, the ocean has always symbolised great mystery, great depths, great profundity. And the implication is that the perfection of wisdom is deep. It's very profound. It's very mysterious. And it's very, very precious. And so, the two big themes of the perfection of wisdom, again pointed out by the verses that we've got here, the two big themes are shunyata, or emptiness, and the bodhisattva, or the bodhisattva ideal. Those are the two themes that occur again and again and again in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And shunyata is a huge subject. I mean, it's a subject that you could do a whole talk on, you could do a whole series of talks on. And in fact, well, whole books have been written about it, which is pretty amusing, really, when you consider that books are written about emptiness. But there you go. And what shunyata is pointing to is that all phenomena lack self-nature. Okay. Nothing is fixed. Everything is in process and is changing all the time. Okay, so that's really that's the essence of what shunyata is about, what emptiness is about. It's not saying nothing exists. It's saying nothing is fixed. Nothing exists of itself. You know, if you can look at something now, if you can capture it now, it won't be the same in the future. It'll change very soon. So shunyata means that however we analyse the world we know, we can't find anything that's unchanging. Okay, and that's pretty important. That's one of the fundamental things about the perfection of wisdom. Everything's unprocessed, nothing is unchanging. And what the early Buddhists did was they made lots of attempts to try and analyse existence. Some of their analysis crops up here. Some of it cropped up last week, actually, in the Heart Sutra. But it crops up here again. You'll recognise that the beginning of the third of the verses you've got here, the second one that I read out, the first line is, in form, feeling, will, perception and awareness. So in the Heart Sutra, do you remember? Form, feeling, choice. Form, feeling, thought, choice and consciousness. Okay, and so it's just a slightly different translation here of the five skandhas. And those were kind of, that was an attempt by early Buddhists to say, okay, if you analyse anything, but particularly if you analyse the things we really care about, you know, if we analyse me, we analyse myself, what do we find? We find some form, some stuff. We find feeling. We find will, my kind of volition, the things that I do. We find perception, the things that I'm perceiving, hearing, seeing, and so on. And my awareness. And what early Buddhists said, that's all there is. There are those five. And actually, if you look at each of those five in turn, none of them is fixed. They're all constantly changing. My feelings are constantly changing. My form's constantly changing. The cells in my fingers are turning over. I can't remember how long it takes for every cell in my body to turn over, but it's a few years, and then I'm a completely different person. And certainly I'm a completely different person to the person I was when I was 3, and even the person that I was when I was 33. So my form is constantly changing, my feelings are changing, my thoughts change. You know, what I decide to do changes, my perceptions change, my awareness changes. Everything's in a constant process of change. So, so in the Perfection of Wisdom, the people who wrote these Perfection of Wisdom sutras are at pains to say, well, wherever you look, you're not going to find anything that has any fixed identity. Everything's changing constantly. In the second to the last line of the verse that you've got in front of you, we've got another word that was used by early Buddhists to analyse existence, and that's the word dharmas. And dharmas here is used in a different sense to the sense in which we use it when we talk about the Dharma. When we talk about the Dharma, we're talking about the truth, or the truth teachings, the teaching of the Buddha. Dharmas here is used in a completely different way. It's got a completely different meaning. And the meaning is, the meaning is, loosely, the meaning is phenomena. It's kind of, dharmas are the thing, the sort of smallest things you can reduce existence down to. If you want to be more precise about the definition of it, I'll read you how Sangharakshita describes dharmas. He says, when you look at anyone or anything closely enough, when you analyse them or it down far enough, you end up with no more than a flow of impersonal psychophysical processes. It is these ultimate psychophysical elements or events that are called dharmas. Okay, so he's saying you analyse things down, you analyse them down and down and down and down, and in the end, well, what you get is you just get processes, you get change. You get things in a process of change, things changing. Dharmas are kind of the basic building blocks of which people and things, the world we know it, are made. And in a way, modern physicists are engaged in a similar process to those early Buddhists. They're kind of trying to analyse everything down and down and down to the basic building blocks of existence. But they're confining themselves to the material world. In a way, early Buddhists were taking a broader view of it because they were trying to analyse not only the physical world, but the world of awareness as well, the world of feeling as well. But whatever dharmas are, they're not going to give us the answer because dharmas are denied in a way as well by the Perfection of Wisdom literature. So they're saying, it's saying here, nowhere will a bodhisattva find a place to rest. And without a home, so they haven't found anywhere to rest, they've got nothing, they haven't found anything to rely upon, nothing to kind of support them, as Shantabhadri was saying last week. Without a home they wander, dharmas will never hold them. Dharmas are constantly changing, they're not going to support us, they're not going to stay the same, we can't rely on them. So, however you analyse reality, whether you divide it into dharmas or you divide it into skandhas, what you get in the final analysis is there is nothing fixed. Or conversely, what you get is a continuous stream of processes, a continuous stream of change in which everything kind of combines and arises and then ceases. Things are created and then destroyed. Things are born and then die. And things become other things. Everything changes. So the converse of nothing is fixed is everything is completely interconnected. Completely and intimately interconnected. And so Shunyata has both of those meanings. It means everything's completely empty. We can't find anything to rely on. We can't find anything that's fixed. And it means, well, everything is just a big flow of change and everything is interconnected. So, we can't cling to dharmas because they're empty. We can't cling to skandhas because they're empty. And, as we learned with Shantavajri in the Heart Sutra last week, we can't even hold on to the most revered teachings of the Dharma. We can't even hold on to the Four Noble Truths, the Wheel of Life. Not even they are fixed. Everything's empty. There's nothing to hold on to. Or, in the words of Buddha Ghosha, who's a medieval Indian sage, just bare phenomenon roll on, dependent on conditions all. Just bare phenomenon roll on, dependent on conditions all. And this is the great mystery, the great emptiness, the great interconnectedness. This is shunyata. So, yeah, the second big theme of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras is the Bodhisattva. And probably most of you know, I think we've made this distinction before, that there are two senses of the word Bodhisattva. There's the archetypal beings, like Tara and Avalokiteshvara. So that's one meaning of the word Bodhisattva. And the other meaning of the word Bodhisattva is a human being who has become enlightened and who's devoting themselves to the welfare of other human beings. And I guess it's mostly the second meaning of the word. It's in the second meaning of the word that Bodhisattva is used in the Perfection of Wisdom literature. Though actually, when you start thinking about it, maybe the two aren't so far apart, but I'll leave you to think about that separately. So a Bodhisattva is a being who's recognised the truth, who's recognised how things really are, and who enjoys the Perfection of Wisdom. And their response to the truth of interconnectedness is to work for the enlightenment of all beings, while seeing that the concept of beings is completely illusory. Okay, so the Bodhisattva will recognise that there's no such fixed and permanent thing as Suryamati, or any of you, but a Bodhisattva will want to help me anyway. Okay. Even though I'm completely illusory, even though I've got no fixed existence, a Bodhisattva will still want to help. Okay. So, you could say that the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras are written for the enjoyment of Bodhisattvas and to assist aspiring Bodhisattvas, which is us really, isn't it? We're aspiring Bodhisattvas. So you could say, in summary, that the Perfection of Wisdom literature is about shunyata, about experiencing things as they really are, and about the Bodhisattva ideal, which is responding to that realization. Okay, that, in a nutshell, is what the Perfection of Wisdom literature is about. Okay, so if you're still baffled, then that's good, because the Perfection of Wisdom literature is meant to baffle you. So if you really haven't got it, then just stay with me, because it's going to get easier now. And one of the great things about the Ratnaguna Samchayagata, and the reason that I love it so much, is that the Ratnaguna Samchayagata gives you some really good advice about how to approach the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And that good advice is in the first verse, which is called the Preliminary Admonition of the Ratnaguna Samchayagata, which we're going to read in a minute. And I think this is fantastic because it's really good advice about just approaching the Dharma in general, even approaching anything in general, actually. And the important thing about it is it doesn't say sharpen your wits. It doesn't say get your pens out and make loads of notes. It's much more like John's approach. I was talking to John last week, John here, who's looking at the floor, after the Heart Sutra talk last week. And he said, well, it's about listening with your heart. And actually, what this verse is saying is that you listen to the Perfection of Wisdom literature with your heart. You don't listen with your head. You don't listen with your intellect. Okay, so listening with your heart. Just listen to the preliminary admonition from the Ratnaguna Samchayagata. And again, either follow the words or just close your eyes and listen. And this one's worth learning by heart, I think. I learnt it by heart. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements. and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the weal of the world, for heroic spirits intended. Okay, I'll read it again because it's so good. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the weal of the world, for heroic spirits intended. Okay, so I think this verse is fantastic. And for lots of reasons, which I'll now go into. And the first is that it starts off in a really encouraging way. It starts off by saying, as much as you can. It's saying, have a go. It's saying, don't worry if you haven't got the necessary qualities perfectly or plentifully. It's saying every human being has some of the right sort of stuff, the right sort of qualities to be able to respond to the perfection of wisdom. So draw on whatever you can contact in the way of positive emotions. Don't think you can't start because you haven't got enough. Have a go with whatever you can find. And I think that's a great way to start off. It's really encouraging us. And then it's talking about, the things that will help. It's saying, call forth as much as you can of love. And love here is, it's not metta. Love here is the Sanskrit word prema, which is unusual, actually, in a sutra like this, because normally prema is the word that's used for sort of the attached, exclusive love of love affairs. It's that kind of love. So this isn't an exhortation to metta. It's an invitation to let ourselves go, to really let rip in a passionate love affair with the perfection of wisdom. And if we're going to be passionate, if we're going towards attachment, then let's have a love affair with the Dharma. Okay, so we've got to call forth as much as we can of love, of respect. And respect here is the word gaurava. It means respect or reverence. It's the same word that was used in the story of the Buddha when, after his enlightenment, he feels he wants something to revere. It's an interesting story because, I think it shows that human beings need something to look up to. Human beings need something to revere, something that's kind of bigger than them. And even the Buddha, after his enlightenment, felt that need. And what the Buddha found he could revere, respect, so the same word, was that he could revere the Dharma. But it's the same word that's used here. The Buddha decided he could revere the Dharma because it's vast and deep like a mighty ocean. And in a way, the Buddha is setting us an example of how to approach the perfection of wisdom, which is, after all, the essence of the Dharma. Respect gaurava also, it also means weighty. It's got the same root as guru. The guru means kind of one weighty in spiritual qualities. So gaurava or reverence is inviting us to have a sense of wonder, a sense of awe. We're approaching something weighty, much bigger than us, really profound, really wonderful, really awesome. So it's inviting us to just prepare by kind of summoning up a sense of awe and respect. And then it's saying we need as much as we can of faith. And there's another unusual word used here, because usually faith is a translation of the word shraddha, but here it's prasada. And the translation of prasada is lucid faith. It's got quite a lot of meanings, actually. It can also be translated as confidence or serenity, pellucidity, transparency of mind. It's almost like sparkly mind because it's got associations of joy and happiness. It can be translated as serene, happy, maybe even blissful. Blissful confidence and trust in the Dharma. And faith is really important in Buddhism. But not faith in the sense of belief. Faith in the sense of an intuitive, heartfelt response to what is bigger, what is higher, what is more real than ourselves. Sangharakshita describes faith as the response of what is ultimate in us to to what is ultimate in the universe, what is highest in us to what is highest in the universe. Okay, so in this line, I think that we're being told to develop receptivity. It's saying we need love, we need respect, we need faith, we need three qualities that will help us respond to the truth with a capital T. And they're all heart qualities, they're not intellectual qualities. They're qualities that will enable us to open up, will make us receptive. They'll soften our consciousness. They'll make us malleable so that we can respond to the truth with our hearts. And, just as a kind of aside, I thought, well, what helps us to develop that kind of receptivity? Because actually that's really important that we've got that receptivity. And here are just a short list of ways. You might be able to think of others. The first and the obvious one is meditation. Meditating actually helps us to experience a kind of different state of mind. And particularly if we can get into a good meditative state, if we can get into higher meditative states, into dhyanas, then we've prepared ourselves in the traditional way for reflection on something like the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. In particular, the Metta Bhavana is a good aid to developing receptivity, because that helps us to develop openness towards others. And that, in a way, is an insight practice, because it's opening to others, opening our hearts to others, as a preparation for opening our hearts to reality. And in that sense, the Metta Bhavana is not just about, you know, developing loving kindness, it's also an insight meditation practice. Just ordinary acts of kindness and generosity help to make us more receptive. Because every time we give, every time we're generous, we're kind of breaking down the shell that surrounds me and myself and my good and my welfare, and kind of reaching out to others. And that makes us more receptive. So it's, you know, practicing generosity could be an insight practice, because it's helping to break down that barrier of self. Spending time with our Buddhist friends, with people in the Sangha, any friends really who are skillful and who are kind and who can with whom we can just be ourselves. Just spending time with friends can help us develop receptivity. And then finally, a final one on my list, devotional practices, mantras and pujas help us to develop that kind of receptive quality that we need to understand with our hearts what the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras are about. So, second line of this wonderful verse, remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. The word used for defilements here is kleshas. And I think you might have come across the term kleshas. Kleshas come in sets. You can have the three kleshas, or the five kleshas, or the 10 kleshas. It's a bit like the Perfection of Wisdom, really. And the basic three are the three poisons that you probably all know. They're the famous three of greed, hatred, and delusion. And actually, the other list, the five and the 10, are kind of expansions of those. And clear away all your taints. Taints is the word mala, I think, which means stains. And I was just wondering what these were, reflecting on what these were. I think that they're the things that hold me back. I think that my stains, my taints, are the things that I'm ashamed of, and the habits in the present that I find it hard to overcome. And for some people, these can be real shackles that really do hold them back. They think they'll never get anywhere because they're such awful people. And we're invited to clear them away. We're invited to clear away our taints, just sweep them out of the path. Okay, they're there, and we do need to do something about them. But just for now, let them go. Don't let them stop us from being receptive to the truth. Actually, this reminded me of an incident in my childhood, which I'll tell you about very briefly. I grew up in a fairly small house, in a very large family. There were seven children in my family. And the most disorganised and untidy day of the week was Monday, which is washing day. And you can imagine, if you've got seven children, and a husband who does a manual job, then on Monday you've got an awful lot of washing to do. And so Mondays were characterised by huge piles of dirty washing, and then later in the day by huge piles of clean washing and masses of ironing. And so whenever you came into our house on Monday, the house was a complete tip. It was complete chaos. And into the middle of one Monday, washing day, walked unannounced because the letter hadn't arrived from California, walked my Auntie Ruth from California. Now, Auntie Ruth was the member of the family who'd emigrated to California in her youth, and she was surrounded by a kind of aura of glamour and riches because every Christmas she sent us a cheque with quite a lot of dollars in that we used to buy Christmas presents. And so Auntie Ruth was kind of, we'd never met her before, but she was greatly revered, and we all thought she must be incredibly posh. And she knocked at the door, and I answered the door, actually, and kind of answered the door, and there's this woman standing there, and she introduced herself, and I was horrified, and I sort of took her inside, and my mother was horrified, because, you know, here was the house with piles of washing everywhere, it's complete chaos, nowhere to sit down. And she said, well, didn't you get my letter? And of course we hadn't had the letter. And my mother was completely mortified. And I talked to her about it afterwards, and I said, but, you know, everyone has washing days. And my mother said, yeah, but it's not very conducive, is it? I mean, you know, there's nowhere to sit. You know, how can I relax, and how can she relax in a house where you've got piles of washing everywhere, where it's complete chaos, where there's, you know, there's water sloshing around on the floor and the ironing board's out, and, you know, it was just chaos. And in a way that illustrates the point. There's something about just clearing away our dirty washing, just to make ourselves receptive to the perfection of wisdom. We're kind of clearing away our taints, clearing away the things that we know we've got to work on, just for the moment, just while we listen to it, just to see whether we can receive it and really hear it with our hearts. So we shouldn't let our habits and our tendencies or our shame for past deeds hold us back. We do need to work on our ethical practice, but, yeah, let's be receptive. Okay, I'm going to have to speed up, I think. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas. Listen is the word shruta. It also means learn. And, I think it's significant that we're being told to listen to the wisdom of the perfect Buddhas, not to understand it. It's not saying understand it. It's not saying get your head round it. It's just saying listen. So it is about receptivity again. It's got kind of intuitions. It's got implications of intuition, which is a word that gets a bad press sometimes because it's often used as a kind of excuse to justify prejudices. But real intuition is not about justifying what we want to be true. Real intuition is heart knowledge. It's listening with a heart. It's knowing in our heart what's good and what's right and what's true without necessarily being able to explain that completely. And in a way, intuition or faith is the nearest we get to enlightenment, this side of enlightenment. Early in the path, intuition can give us even the faintest glimmer of what enlightenment is like. So it's really, really important. Little flashes in which we see what's true, in which we can't just know the direction that we need to take. And we've all had these, you know, however faint, or we wouldn't be here, we wouldn't be sitting here if we hadn't. And for the people who are familiar with the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, these little flashes of perfect vision, they're flashes of perfect vision, this first stage in the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. So they're not the result of working on something intellectually, they're the result of just seeing into the nature of reality, really. Then we've got the wisdom of the gentle Buddhas. I love the idea. Yeah, gentle is the word surita, which as well as being gentle can be translated as humble. And I just love the idea that the Buddha could be humble. And really it's quite an important idea because the Buddha's humble because he doesn't make distinctions between himself and other people. He realised that he and everyone else and everything else is part of this big interconnected whole. So naturally, he wants the best for all beings. And that's where the idea of the Bodhisattva comes from. When we realise the perfection of wisdom, when we realise the truth, we realise that there's no difference between us and other beings. So naturally, we'd want the best for everybody else. And finally, taught for the wheel of the world, for heroic spirits intended. Wheel is an old-fashioned word for welfare, for the good of. And wheel of the world means the good, the benefit of the world. The Bodhisattva wants to benefit all beings. He wants the best for them. He wants happiness for all beings. So naturally, the Bodhisattva wants to teach all beings the perfection of wisdom. And finally, heroic spirits. Heroic spirits is a translation of the word shura, which means heroes or heroines. Which is part of Kenna Suri's name, because Suri is the feminine form of Sura. So Sura or Suri is often used for bodhisattvas, and it's kind of implying that the perfection of wisdom is intended for bodhisattvas and for aspiring bodhisattvas, and that's us. And actually, there's a sense in which every person in this room has some degree of heroism. Because it does take courage to go against the flow. It takes courage to decide that you're going to come here on a Tuesday night to listen to talks, however baffling they are, about wisdom and reality, while the rest of the world wants to sweep us up towards consumerism and wealth, gathering wealth, building our status, increasing our security. We're really going against the flow, and that does take a bit of heroism, a bit of courage. It takes courage to keep going with our practice when we're distracted, when we're pushed and pulled by negative emotions, when we're beset by doubts. And we've all experienced those to some degree too, I imagine. So in a sense, we're all heroic spirits. We're all bodhisattvas in the making. So this line is reminding us that the spiritual life is a heroic one. It's a life lived pursuing a heroic quest in which we'll have to overcome difficulties, we'll have to keep going when we're tired and discouraged, we'll have to face up to our own limitations, we'll have to seek help from our friends, and we'll have to dig deep into our resources of courage. But if we're up for that heroic quest, and we can all do it because, well, we've all begun it, and some of us have come quite a long way, actually, then we have got what it takes to penetrate the truth that's pointed at by the perfection of wisdom literature. So we won't get it. We're not going to get it, really, until we become enlightened. But in the meantime, if we make ourselves receptive and refuse to be dragged down by difficulties and listen with our hearts, we can use the Perfection of Wisdom text to remind us that reality is not about the intellect. It's about interconnectedness. It's about being heroes and heroines in our own quests. And most of all, it's about love.